The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am well, although apparently temporarily losing my voice.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends, though I hope they can actually talk.
Yeah, what was up with that?
I have no idea. I'm sorry.
Get it together. All right. First
I'm
up,
sorry.
In controversies... First up in controversies and non-controversies. Alyssa can't talk. No, just kidding. All right. Oscar nominations are out. Emilia Perez took home 13 nominations, tied for the second most of all time. Emilia Perez, number two on that list with so many greats. The Brutalist and Wicked both scored 10 nominations apiece, while other Best Picture nominees like A Complete Unknown, Conclave, Dune Part 2, grabbed a handful each. It's pretty standard mix. We'll get to Emilia Perez in a second. There's much controversy about it. I'm not even going to say controversy or not, just controversy about its nominations. But a few things that jumped out include both Sebastian Stan and Jeremy Strong getting nominations in acting categories for The Apprentice, the movie about Donald Trump's relationship with mentor Roy Cohn that kind of got buried at the box office last year. Some people thought Sebastian Stan was going to get a nomination for A Different Man. Turns out he got it for playing Donald Trump in the movie The Apprentice. We'll see how that goes. There was no Best Director nomination for Denis Villeneuve for Dune Part 2. Less controversially for John Chu for Wicked. I know the fans of both of those movies are very outraged by this. And really, like, the big story overall is that there's just a lack of big pictures vying for the top awards. Set aside Wicked and Dune Part 2 getting nominations, and I guess Wicked could still win Best Picture. I don't think it's super likely at this point now. But there, you know, it's a real stark contrast to last year's nominations when Oppenheimer had grossed almost $1 billion worldwide and was heavily favored to win Best Picture. Barbie was also in the mix for a lot of different awards, so I think it didn't end up winning any. There are certainly movies that I felt like were snubbed. I don't like when my movies are snubbed. Civil War. One of my favorite movie of last year, zero nominations. Nonsense and stuff. Furiosa, I thought, deserved more than zero nominations, at least in the technical categories. Nosferatu probably should have been up for some of the bigger prizes. I think Nosferatu should have been a Best Picture nominee. That's a relatively big movie. It's going to gross about $100 million domestic. People like it. It should have been up for some of the bigger prizes instead of just the technical categories. But overall, it's a very solid lineup of nominees and a relatively weak year for movies, I think. Except, again, for the bonkers nomination total for Emilia Perez. A historical analogy worth considering momentarily before we dive into this. In his book, Pictures at a Revolution, Mark Harris noted that it was very odd to see an old-fashioned movie like Dr. Doolittle up for Best Picture against the likes of Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate. You know, that was a big year of change. Lots of new, young, appealing movies were coming out. And then here was a stodgy old Dr. Doolittle, a ridiculous musical, huge bomb at the box office. Nobody liked it. However, it was the 20th Century Fox's big movie that year. It was their big award season movie, and the studio leaned on its massive Rolodex to secure the nomination. The Oscars then, as now, are at least partly about back scratching, right? And no one has a bigger back to scratch than Netflix at this point. They're producing more stuff than anyone else. So anytime they have their movie, it gets nominated for lots and lots of things. That's why every year you have some prestige or prestige-y picture like Mank or Roma or The Power of the Dog rack up a bunch of nominations, only to lose in virtually every category the movie is nominated in before it disappears into the streaming morass and no one ever thinks about watching them ever again. Emilia Perez is this year's submission for the forgettable morass. It seems to have more momentum than any of those movies, however, which is kind of interesting. At least part of that momentum stems from the, I'm gonna say something a little bit problematic here. My language is gonna be a little bit problematic. Totally insane idea that voting for the French musical about the trans cartel boss is a way to surreptitiously stick it to Donald Trump. This is explicitly how one writer for The Wrap put it in a piece headlined Oscar Nominations, Love for Emilia Perez and The Apprentice Could Make Oscar Night Donald Trump's Nightmare. Matthew Bellany, writing for Puck, suggested something similar, that, quote, either voters want to stick it to the openly anti-transgender president and pick the movie built around its trans star, or the Academy would prefer to not poke the bear and instead go for something else, end quote. The implication here kind of being that not voting for the disastrous mess of a musical that is Emilia Perez signals cowardice in the face of authoritarianism or some such. I cannot emphasize enough that this is the absolute worst way to look at Emilia Perez. Literally nothing. There's nothing that could play into Trump's hands more than the great Satan of Hollywood giving their biggest honor to a French musical about, again, a trans cartel boss. You can practically imagine the truths that he would fire off about, you know, the sicko degenerates and La La Land to Holly Weird who hate the good common people of America, blah, blah, blah. Now, avoiding this response is also not a good reason not to award Emilia Perez, right? Like, that is not, we don't want to go down that road either. A good reason not to award Emilia Perez is that it's campy nonsense with terrible songs and a bunch of really awful performances. Whatever. If you think it's the best movie of the year, vote for it. If you don't think it's the best movie of the year, but you want to, you know, really show how hard you're resisting, please, for the love of God, don't. Do not vote for this out of some sort of misguided idea of resistance. This is my begging. I'm begging the Academy. Alyssa, you look, you're more in touch with like the normie lib contingent.
I mean, am I even the universe, anymore?
I think.
Who knows?
I think I am. Just please tell them I'm right here. The crazy conservative on the panel is in fact correct here.
I actually think I hated Emilia Perez more than either of you two. I just like, it's awful and it makes no sense. I will say, I do think the two significant performances in it are fairly good, but it's just an insane, it's just insane, right? It's just, I'm sorry, the whole thing, it's bonkers, but it's not transcendently bonkers. And the idea that it should be taken as sort of a symbol of anything or sort of a, I am so immune to this movie, I would actually say that I'm allergic to it, that the idea of it being taken as sort of like a symbol.
Were you inoculated by Big Pharma?
Vaxxed? No. no, I am just, I am allergic to this movie. I think adopting it as a symbol of any sort of resistance or even of sort of any particular meaning or insight is just such a wild act of projection, totally sort of unrelated to the text itself, that I think it would be so radically self-discrediting to embrace it as meaningful in any way that I hope that people avoid it just because it's like, it has no politics. It has no psychological insight. It's just insane. And I'm sorry, I'm literally rendered speechless by the decision, by the idea that this is like one of the most Oscar-nominated movies of all time. It feels like Hollywood is just having an episode. And I, you know, I am not someone who is like, yes, John Voight, Sylvester Stallone, and Mel Gibson should like parachute into Hollywood as like a three-man strike team and set things right. But like this...
Tropic Thunder 2.
This movie winning Best Picture would like kind of sell me on that. I just... Please, everybody, like, stop having an episode and don't go bananas for this movie. It's not worth it. It's just, it would not produce any sort of useful reaction. It is not a useful movie to, like, promote trans rights. Like, it's just...
Well, Alyssa, one thing that is interesting about this movie is that you have a contingent of, like... Left, like, there's, again, the way I describe the base of this movie is kind of like normie lib, you know, like, here's a movie about inclusion and that's what we want to celebrate. But like left, like actual left wing people hate this movie. Like actual trans rights activists kind of hate this movie, right? Like it is so misguided and kind of the opposite of the messages that they're trying to get out there that it doesn't work for them.
I guess, I mean, I don't even understand. I think part of the reason I'm so flabbergasted about this is because if there is sort of a strong normie lib constituency for this movie, I'm not seeing it. And if there was going to be sort of a strong normie lib constituency for a movie, like, why not Conclave, right? That movie's take on sort of gender identity is, you know, sort of more is, in a way, sort of trickier than the one in Emilia Perez, but it's much more a statement of, like, you know, just inherent faith in, like, decency and kindness and, like, we should, you know, support people who are victimized. It's the much more sort of normie lib movie insensibility. So I literally can't get my mind around either the political or aesthetic response to Emilia Perez. I don't see the constituency for it bubbling up anywhere, which may also be, you know, a factor of the fact that, like, I'm sort of hanging around X in a desultory fashion. And, like, maybe the support for Emilia Perez is all happening on, like, Blue Sky or Threads or something. But I don't know where the audience for that movie, which I suppose exists, is, like, hanging out and making its case. And I feel like that says something more maybe about the fragmentation of sort of movie Twitter or like normie, you know, lib cultural discourse than it does about.
Wait, is it happening on Letterboxd? I'm not on Letterboxd. I don't know.
No, Letterboxd. So again, Letterboxd is, you know, nothing but 20-year-old Zoomers, and they all hate this movie because, again, the politics of it are bad in the general sense of how you're supposed to support trans rights, et cetera, et cetera. But Peter, there is a constituency for this movie, and I find this disconnect fascinating. Because I like Alyssa, I see very few people like actively defending this movie that continues to win awards all throughout Hollywood, and that it does. The interesting thing, Peter, is that there does seem to be a sort of immunity from controversy, right? This is the sort of movie that, like, 10 years ago, there would have been huge viral campaigns about, like, this movie doesn't represent Mexican people. Mexican people reject this movie. Trans people reject this movie. How can the industry celebrate this movie that is nominally about these people that the groups themselves have rejected? And that conversation simply does not seem to exist this year about this movie.
Yeah, and I do wonder to a certain extent if this is much more an indicator of the collapse of the sort of, you know, widespread cultural conversation than it is of anything about the movie or even the state of Hollywood.
That is exactly what is happening. Look, it's hard to prove. There's not like a survey number you can point to. But we can all see, we have talked about on this podcast, you can see it in box office numbers, you can see it just if you are a film fan, the cultural influence of Hollywood, especially Hollywood proper, the big studios, the big releases that go to movies, but also this, I get the movie theaters, but also just kind of award season Hollywood and prestige Hollywood, which this is a part of. Yes, this was obviously not a film that played really, it may have played in a few movie theaters in a token way, but it was a Netflix movie first and foremost. But the expensive feature film with from an auteur or with a name brand actor or whatever, the kinds of movies that used to just that used to be part of water cooler conversation back when people went to offices and talked at water coolers, don't enter into those conversations at nearly the same level. I'm not saying no one in the world has ever talked about them, but it is much more of a niche hobby now to be a movie fan than it was in the 1980s or the 1990s or even in the mid aughts. And that started, I think, we saw that's partially a result of media fragmentation and then partially a result of the collapse of theater going and other issues with Hollywood that have happened because of the pandemic and theaters being closed for a year. And then because of the strikes where they shut down production for 6 months. And that is one of the things that we've seen this year. One of the reasons why this is a weak year for movies is because there was 6 months of we're not going to make anything. We're just going to yammer and talk about labor issues. And we're not going to do the thing that is our job, which is make movies. And all of this is happening in the context of a pretty significant cultural shift that is happening, that is political, that is partly political, but not entirely political. If you have been reading political punditry for the past week or so, there have been a half a dozen, if not more, quite prominent, widely shared columns and feature essays about the vibe shift, about the about Trump's cultural power, about the sort of rising cultural valence of the right, which is tied up with big tech, with Elon Musk, with, Mark Zuckerberg changing his hair and wearing gold chains and going on Joe Rogan and talking about how companies need more masculine energy and to embrace aggression and how they've been kind of neutered, right? And the HRification of everything. And Ezra Klein wrote probably the most perceptive and most shared piece about this in the New York Times, touched off a bunch of discussion. And the question he asked, the sort of the thesis of the piece was Trump's victory at the polls was actually not that big. It was just about 1.5 points. But it feels like a sort of overwhelming cultural knockout victory, like a huge sweep of the culture. And I think a lot of people are feeling that. And it's not clear exactly what all of that portends. And so to me, to see Emilia Perez get this level of get nominated like this, right? Like a not quite historically, but like nearly historic number of nominations. And then to see it explicitly framed by writers like the one you quoted in the rap, Sonny. Let's presume that that is let's just take that as like true, even like that the reason that people are supporting this. I'm not saying I don't even know if I think it is true, but let's just for the sake of conversation, assume that that is at least a major reason driving support for Emilia Perez. It's maybe the art doesn't support it, right? Maybe the actual movie doesn't support a sort of pro trans or, you know, whatever the kind of the left-leaning political message, but it's the vehicle they have, right? Like it's the button they can push because there's not another, yeah, maybe Conclave, but there's not like, this is the thing that they can go with.
Wicked, and, like that's, I mean, it's got all of the clunky metaphors. I mean, it's obviously less audacious, but it's in some ways a much clearer sell.
But it's a clearer sell, but that's part of the reason why it's not a good vehicle for a sort of screw you politics, because that's if you take the thesis that people are supporting this as an F you to Donald Trump
or might
like if that is correct, then there's a reason that it's this and not Amelia Perez, excuse me, and not Wicked and not Conclave even, right? Which is actually a pretty conventional kind of mystery up until about the last 10 minutes there. And Alyssa, you said something when you were talking about this that I think is right, which is that, I forget the exact phrase you used, but like it is, you said that if Hollywood, if that's what Hollywood's doing, it is self-discrediting. And I kind of think it is self-discrediting here. It is, and it, and the fact is that Hollywood in this arena, in the political cultural arena, what we are, what we have seen over the past week, over the past several months, in some ways over the past several years, just in terms of its kind of declining overall influence, is that Hollywood has in a bunch of ways self, like discredited itself. And I think that is unfortunate in so many ways, and it's unnecessary. There are movies that could be championed here that don't, that, that even are quite quite left-leaning or progressive. That's like, it's possible to sort of do this in a way that is, that isn't just shooting yourself in the foot, but that's not what's happening, because that is not how Hollywood operates. And this seems to me like, I don't know if it's a last gasp, but a sort of desperate flailing attempt to project cultural political power that they're just not, they're going to fail. It's not going to work. If this isn't gonna, they're not getting outrage because nobody cares anymore. Like the fact that there's no outrage about it, that it's not even driving, I guess it's possible that there's somebody out there who's outraged, but there's no sort of, there's no mass rejection of this. And that just tells you, like, this is a doomed endeavor from an industry that views itself as a an arbiter of cultural power, but no longer has any itself.
No, but see, I think this is kind of wrong, that in the sense that there is a fairly concerted, I've seen it online. There is a fairly concerted anti Amelia Perez block in the commentariat, but it's totally ineffective as far as I can tell in terms of like turning people against the movie, which is kind of interesting in and of itself. And it reminds me, the movie it most reminds me of, weirdly, is Green Book. You remember Green Book?
Yep. So I was just about to say that.
So Green Book was a fascinating movie because Green Book is like a very traditional Oscar sort of movie. It's like broadly liberal with this big message about, you know, tolerance and equality and
good stuff.
Opposing racial discrimination, et cetera, et cetera. It has some big performances at the center of it. Mahershala Ali is very good in it, and what's his name from Lord of the Rings is very good in it. Yeah, thank you. But there were a lot of people who really didn't want that movie to win at the Oscars. They're like, this is too old fashioned. You know, we are in the age of Moonlight, not the age of Green Book. This is the sort of movie that shouldn't be winning anymore. And nobody in Hollywood actually cared. And the reason for that, as someone, maybe it was Richard Rushfield, friend of the show, explained to me, was like, it doesn't actually, if Hollywood likes a movie, they don't care about controversy. They don't care. They do not care about the like kind of nitpicky, you know, identity politics stuff. If they really like a movie, they are going to support it, which leads us to the worst possible implication here, which is that
they
the
just
industry
like this
loves
movie.
Amelia Perez. They just love this movie. They watch it. You have guys like James Cameron out there saying, oh, this is one of the best movies I've ever seen. This is so full of energy and life. Guillermo del Toro's out there saying similar things. Like, there's a loud vocal contingent of people who really love this movie. And that is possibly the scariest part of all this.
Yeah. I mean, I respect it. I respect a decision to vote for this movie for Best Picture that's based on the fact that you love it, but also explain to me why. Like, I have yet to read, like, the great convincing case for Amelia Perez. And, you know, it's been a busy month. But I just, it is the rare movie where I am just baffled by the idea that there could be genuine affection for it. And there are very few things that I find, like, I don't know, inherently meritless or, but it just, this movie makes me feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
I'm glad. I often feel that way about lots of things. So I'm glad it hit you here. All right. So what do we think? Is rewarding Amelia Perez at the Oscars a good way to stick it to Trump, or literally the worst idea anyone has ever had in the history of ideas. Alyssa.
I feel like it would be in some ways such a fitting coda to an era of like progressive politics that has so thoroughly discredited itself that it would make me insane, but I sort of hope it happens because you couldn't script a better cherry on the sundae.
Peter.
This is the Avengers Endgame of... wait, where am I going with that?
Whatever analogy you're trying to work here is the worst analogy that's ever...
Why is everything the best and the worst with you, Sadie? It's a weird movie. Okay. That's what I got for you.
It's a terrible idea. Terrible idea. And anyone who votes for this movie as a means of sticking it to Trump might as well just write him a check for like $500 that he can put in his pocket because you're just helping him out.
Buy the meme coin. Just buy it. Buy the meme coin and give him the money.
So now that everybody's nice and mad at me in particular, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode, looking at Steven Soderbergh's body of work. Speaking of whom, on to the main event. Presence is the latest from Soderbergh. He shot it in like a handful of days, just for a couple million bucks. It's a low budget haunted house movie, not really a horror movie. Specifically, it's a haunted house movie. There's a slight difference in the two here, which maybe we'll discuss a little bit. But it's basically shot from the first person perspective of the titular presence haunting this house. It is haunting, I guess, a family of four. Mom, Rebecca, is played by Lucy Liu. Dad, who is Chris, played by Chris Sullivan. The oldest child, Tyler, played by Eddie Madej. And daughter, Chloe, who is played by Kalina Lang. The presence of presence essentially serves as the camera for the film, roaming through the house and alighting upon conversations as they happen, which gives the film a fairly naturalistic feeling. Not entirely, but fairly. There's little in the way of pure exposition, right? We just kind of pick up things as we go. Among the things we pick up, Chloe has lost two of her friends recently to what appear to be self-induced overdoses, possibly suicides. Mom prefers the all-American Tyler to the depressed Chloe, who has been in and out of therapy. At one point, she says about her daughter, "We can't let her drag us down," which is like one of the wildest things I think I've ever heard a character say about their own child in a movie. She is in some sort of legal trouble, the mom, not the daughter, the mom, though the extent of what that legal trouble is never made wholly clear. It's kind of in and of itself is a specter kind of haunting the house. And the dad in the movie is at a breaking point, particularly with his son, Tyler, who is kind of a jerk. Kind of a big jerk in this movie, this kid who's a champion swimmer, moving to the new school, who wants to be big man on campus, but he's really just a little shit. It's not entirely naturalistic, though, as the presence in presence can do things like move books around and make them float around, or he can shake drinks off of table. Why is it interacting with the family? Is it trying to scare them away, to warn them about something? What is it even? Is it Chloe's friend Naomi, something or someone else? Nobody is entirely sure. We'll talk spoilers in a minute, I'm sure. So if you don't want to hear them, you should probably log off now. Suffice to say, I certainly like this movie a lot. I know Peter did. Alyssa, I'm curious to see what you made. But if you're worried about spoilers, shut off the episode, come back, go see the movie, come back, and you can listen to it then. If you're not, one thing I will say, again, this is mostly spoiler-free, but you know, you might be a little worried about it. One thing I will say is that the script for this movie by David Koepp is impeccably tight. I once heard a screenwriter say something like the following. Audiences think that if they can guess the ending of a movie, that the screenwriter has failed at their job, that they've made it too obvious, that, you know, that's not how surprises should work. But that's not quite right. The real goal is to make it so that the audience guesses the ending about 90 seconds before it happens. Because if you can do that, it means you have written everything in a way that not only makes sense, but pays off logically. And by that measure, Presence is a masterpiece, I think. Everything unfolds perfectly logically. The final shot, you realize what's happening as it's happening, more or less. It feels both inevitable and shattering. Maybe we'll discuss specifically what happens, but it just is a... It's really well done and hits you just right. Setting aside the movie itself, great script, solid performances, neat concept. The story of its making is pretty wonderful. It's a cheap picture. It's shot over a handful of days. And Soderbergh himself did the camera work, editing the picture as he went. According to one interview, he said he locked the picture. That is, he had his cut of the movie done just half an hour after finishing filming, thanks to the lack of special effects and doing the editing as he went, et cetera, et cetera. It was just a really well-planned picture. Didn't cost much money. It may not be a huge box office hit, but that's fine because it didn't really cost that much to make. I feel like we need more of this sort of thing. I don't know. Peter, what did you make of Presence?
So since we started by talking about the Oscars and their cultural relevance, it's actually interesting to think about Steven Soderbergh, who in 2013 said he was retiring from filmmaking. And the reason he said that he was retiring was that movies just aren't culturally relevant anymore. And it feels like nobody's really talking about them. This was, again, 12 years ago. Now, since then, he's made about 10 or 12 movies and also directed, produced at least one TV show, The Nick, where he was at, like, I don't know if he directed every episode, but he directed a bunch of it, was sort of overseeing a bunch of it, and also editing it himself in a van every night as he came home from shooting, right? This is sort of how he works. And there has been a shift in his filmmaking since he retired and then unretired. There has been a shift in his filmmaking where his movies have become in some ways a little bit more disposable. And I don't mean that they've become bad. It just means that it doesn't seem like he really needs every movie to be this big swing masterpiece. Instead, he has accepted that there's a little bit of irrelevance to all of this. And so he can do whatever he wants and he can just try stuff. And it's incredibly freeing. So this movie, you said, was shot over just a handful of days. I believe it was just 11. That is an incredibly, incredibly tight shooting schedule. But because you've got a very small cast and a single location, the presence never leaves this house, with one sort of exception of a very final shot. It's all one location, and it's just a handful of actors. And they can just do this almost like it's a stage play and just film these kind of extended long scenes. And there's not much to do with the editing, right? Like the reason the editing was locked so quickly was because it's just all long takes filmed by Soderbergh himself, who, to be clear, this is not unusual for him. He has been serving as his own cinematographer under the pseudonym Peter Andrews for years. And so what you get is this just fascinating and meticulous formal exercise in which there are a huge number of constraints placed on the way the story is told, on the way it is filmed. There's just all these rules about it, right? Like it's not just that the camera doesn't cut. It's also that the camera has a kind of a personality because it's interested in what's going on, or sometimes it's scared, right? Like one of the things we see it doing is backing into a closet. The focus of it basically always stays at roughly a human head height, right? We don't get shots from the floor or the ceiling or anything like that. It's just kind of walking around the house like a person would be, because it is in some sense a person. And so what Soderbergh and Kep have done is they have created a silent character, a voyeuristic character, right? Who is in some ways an audience stand-in, but is also playing a role in this family drama. And as an exercise and as an experiment, I thought this movie was just incredibly successful. I just loved watching it, and I loved seeing the ways that Soderbergh put together each scene and essentially acted in the film just from behind the camera. I think the movie is a little weaker on the script front. Yes, it's really tight, and it's a very good sort of use of these formal constraints. In the screening that I saw, there was a post-movie Q&A that included, it was broadcast, not live. It was like a broadcast, I think that the filmmakers were in New York, but I was able to watch it in DC, but in which David Kep said that he loves these sort of movies with rules, right? Like anything that can box him in, because otherwise sort of creativity goes anywhere. And this just sort of allows, like, this kind of movie allows him to sort of play within, like, oh, you can't do that, right? It tells you all the things you can't do. And I think the script does a good job of providing opportunities for Soderbergh to do interesting filmmaking, but it's a little it doesn't quite deliver for me on the family drama side. Like, there's a bunch of good stuff there, but I felt like all these, it left too many questions unanswered and sort of hanging, and ended up resolving by focusing on a part of the story that you understand why it went there, and we're going to not do spoilers quite yet, but like, you understand why it went, why it ends up focusing on this sort of tertiary side story involving a high school friend. But ultimately, that, like, that friend and sort of like that element of the story is, I think, some of the least interesting stuff right up until the point where you get to the big reveal at the end. So this is a good movie, but it's good mostly, or I think primarily, as a sort of formal exercise, and as a, like, seeing as like novelty filmmaking, right? And seeing something that, like, a filmmaker, like, this is the sort of thing that's difficult to do, like, to find money for and to pull off. But it's wonderful to see Soderbergh, like, play with this format. I'm not sure it didn't quite hit home emotionally for me, like, and it didn't sort of quite come together for me just as a story. It felt like, oh, we're just going to find a way to end this as a sort of in a genre friendly manner, rather than, like, actually develop all of these characters and all of these kind of family drama dynamics that are going on.
Yeah, I disagree with that in the sense that I don't find the movie that interesting as a formal experiment, except in how it all pays off as a piece of storytelling, right? So, like, there have been a couple of interesting kind of formal experiment type movies that have come out the last few months here. There was a Here, the Robert Zemeckis movie, which takes place entirely within this one location, within a house, and you see the years and decades and centuries roll by from it. And then there was Nickel Boys, which is also shot from first person POV and, like, kind of hops back and forth between two characters' first person POVs, and as well as, like, a sequences that are in the future from the film that are shot kind of third person over the shoulder, and all of that comes together in a really compelling way at the end of the film that pays off the filmmaking trick that they're using here. And I think this movie only works because the script pays off that trick in a way that makes it all make sense. I was not, Alyssa, maybe you agree with Peter here. Like, I was not that annoyed or worried by the things that didn't pay off, or the red herrings, or all of that stuff. But this is definitely not a movie that is committed to explaining every storytelling angle that it brings up. It is telling one very specific point of view.
Yeah. I will say, I do think a problem with the movie script is that both Tyler and Rebecca come across as really loathsome for most of the movie. Like, Tyler just seems awful. And you never see anything that, you know, gives him some, like, any sort of charm or curiosity or decency. He just seems like a little monster in the making.
Well, he kind of is.
But also, just, like, Rebecca just seems like such a horrible mother. Like, the sort of the fact that the ghost, I mean, obviously you only see what the ghost sees, right? But it, you know, it just means that some of the character beats don't, I think there's a real limitation to the combination of the script and the camera work. I think it has just some real limitations, and just seeing a little bit, just even just a little bit more balance, you know. Chris is like, it's nice to see a dad who is sort of that kind of consistent and, you know, kind of moral about what it means to be, what he's, you know, says at some point, like, an excellent man. But he also comes across as, like, a little bit of a pushover in some ways. And I wonder if the movie would have benefited from being, like, 6 minutes longer and having just a few more scenes that just add any little bits of shading to the characters other than Chloe.
So would that not have given us a, I mean, doesn't making those the loathsome characters a little more relatable undermine the twist in some ways, because that's the point where we find out.
Yeah, spoilers. We'll go from here. So turn it off if you don't want to know exactly what the presence in presence is. We're going to tell you.
So the spoiler is that the final shot we see that the presence is Tyler, who has been there the whole time watching over this family. And in some ways it doesn't make sense because, of course, he's also in the story. But part of what we hear about the presence is that it doesn't apply, like normal time rules don't apply. Right. And so the redemption comes in that revelation, not in this in something that is set up beforehand.
Yes. In a way, the last sequence of the movie is the pushover father character getting his wish, right? That just for once he'd like to see his son act like a, you know, stick up for his sister, to act like a decent human toward her, to defend her. And of course, like the way the movie plays out, again, spoilers, but if you've seen it, the way the movie plays out is the presence, this boyfriend character is about to murder Chloe as he has murdered the other girls. It turns out he's a serial killer. And the presence, which is, again, Tyler, wakes Tyler up and it gets him up there to her room to save her. And in the course of saving her, both he and this killer kid go tumbling out the window and die. And this is how the ghost is made. He basically accidentally creates him. Now, like, all of that sounds ridiculous saying it out loud. And maybe it is kind of ridiculous. I don't know how much sense any ghost story really needs to make. But within the universe of the film itself, everything that we see there is laid out in stuff that we have heard or kind of been privy to earlier in the film. Within the logical universe of the film, it works perfectly fine. And I think, again, I found it to be incredibly moving, or at least very effective in terms of how it resolves all this. I don't really care that some of the characters are bad people or, you know, kind of like irredeemably awful, it feels like, because I do think there are people like that. I always have trouble going into a movie and saying, like, well, I can't believe a character would act that way.
What did you guys make of the sort of serial killer twist in the movie? Because I found myself disappointed by it, just in the sense that I really sort of enjoyed kind of the banality of the movie up until then.
Yeah. The point I was trying to make is that the movie chooses this sort of exaggerated, pulpy genre story element to focus on, which is the deaths of the two girls who turn out to be killed by a serial killer who uses sort of spiked drugs and with tape over
saran
their mouths, or saran wrap or something, right? Who is this sort of secondary, that kid, the friend, is the least interesting character in the movie. And what's really interesting in this movie, especially for the first 50 minutes or so, is the domestic drama. This is like the low key stuff just at the kitchen table and sitting around in the, you know, the living room where this family that is a wreck is interacting in the way that wreck families, that upper middle class, like in many ways successful, but also falling apart at the foundations, families interact. And that's a great domestic drama with a twist that it is told from the perspective of a ghost who is played by Steven Soderbergh at behind the camera. And I loved all of that stuff. And I get the neatness and the puzzle completion aspect of the twist. I even appreciate it, but I also didn't think it was the most interesting character or drama, like a dramatic aspect of this movie. The most interesting stuff was, what is this family going to do about itself?
Yeah,
I guess, again, in defense of the movie, what is kind of interesting is that watching the movie through the eyes of Tyler's ghost, you see as he goes, I think, there are things that happen in the movie that the spirit, the presence, is clearly reacting to negatively that Tyler did. Tyler like pulls this mean prank on a girl and like acts like it's this big triumph and that everyone should cheer him for it. And the presence freaks out and like starts smashing up his room. And you think like, oh, this is because it's partly a red herring to make you think it's like one of the girls who committed suicide. But it's actually him reacting to himself being an asshole. Like in his ghost self, he is watching and learning how to be a better person. Does that make sense? Like his development as a character is the way he frees his soul, let's say. Like he has to learn to be a better person from beyond the grave. And we watch all of this kind of play out from his silent perspective as this presence, which again, I just think it's really well done. I think it's a really it's just a neat formal trick that also happens to really work within the text of the film itself. I think it's a really remarkable, nice little touch. I don't know.
I agree with a bunch of this. I also think there's probably a middle ground here where the movie could have been like, this is a very tight short film. I mean, 85 minutes with credits, I believe. And I think this movie could have been 10 or even 15 minutes longer and given us something more like a domestic drama resolution, maybe in addition to the serial killer, you know, pulp story resolution.
I don't know how you have a resolution to the family now has a dead kid. It's like, wait, like, what are they supposed to wrap things up with a nice little bow and be like, well, he died saving his sister, so that's good. I feel like that family is broken, and I don't know that there's a way that we watch them and they get fixed. Because there are broken families out there. That's the thing, right? Is that there are just broken, bad families out there. There are broken, bad mothers. There are broken, bad kids. And he, you know, I don't know. All right. So, Alyssa, what did you make of Presence?
I liked it, but not quite as much as I wanted to. Thumbs up, but yeah, with some reservations.
Peter, thumbs up or thumbs down on Presence?
Thumbs up. It's a great filmmaking exercise. And I think even if I didn't have some issues with sort of where the script went, I did appreciate that this is an interesting, like a well-made, it's not just a novelty film. It is a well-made movie that is under 90 minutes. Very rare.
Thumbs up. It's super tight. It's really well-written. And I think it pays everything off remarkably, without kind of wallowing in unnecessary to the film and the story it's trying to tell details, which is rare in a movie these days. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
One of the biggest challenges of earning a degree as a military veteran is transitioning your goals and experiences to your next phase in life. National University gets it. As a veteran-founded Yellow Ribbon School, they offer post-9/11 GI Bill acceptance, dedicated military support and advising services, and credit for your military experience. That's why 30% of their students are military-affiliated. NU, education that serves those who served.